27 years ago, a remarkable moment played out on TV screens across the country.
During this period at the Department of Education, my working relationship with Judge Thomas was positive. I had a good deal of responsibility and independence. I thought he respected my work and that he trusted my judgment.
Anita Hill testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. She said Clarence Thomas, the man nominated to become the next Supreme Court justice, had sexually harassed her when he supervised her in two different government jobs.
After approximately 3 months of working there, he asked me to go out socially with him. What happened next and telling the world about it are the two most difficult things, experiences of my life.
Now, as Christine Blasey Ford accuses Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her as a teenager, the nation is living through this moment again. This is The Takeaway. I'm Amy Walter. And today on the show, we ask, in 27 years, how far have we come? We begin this hour with a woman who knows what it's like to come forward with allegations of abuse and assault.
We have new information this morning about former presidential aide Rob Porter.
New questions about what the Trump administration did or did not do.
Mr. President, do you have a message to domestic violence victims?
The director of the FBI today seemed to dispute the White House timeline.
Information was still coming to the White House Personnel Security Office in February.
The office had not completed the data gathering for Porter's security clearance.
Kelly approved giving Porter an expanded role in the White House.
Story was being told as though I was a third-party object.
Jenny Willoughby is a writer and public speaker. She's also the ex-wife of Rob Porter. A few months into the Trump presidency, reports surfaced from a girlfriend that Porter was physically abusive. Jenny and another ex-wife, Colby Holderness, spoke out about the abuse they endured at his hand. Photos circulated of Colby with a black eye. Porter denied the accusations, but Jenny says while married, her husband was physically and emotionally abusive and at multiple points threatened her. I asked her what it feels like to watch Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's story play out on the national stage.
My immediate reaction was to reach out to connections that I had at the Washington Post, asking to be put in contact with her, and I sent her a personal email just letting her know that I had an inkling of what she was about to be up against and what she probably was undoubtedly facing in terms of attacks and threats from social media, and wanted to let her know that I was there for her.
Did she respond back to you?
No. I can only imagine how overwhelmed she is by media requests and family and everything like that. And so I was just happy to be able to have that out there so that she would know that there was somebody who had been through something similar and had her back.
I want to talk about your specific experience and what it was when you came forward and what compelled you to do that and what was it like?
Something that I think a lot of the public lost or was misinformed on was that I somehow came forward willingly and voluntarily at that moment in order to share my story. And that is not exactly how it happened. I had actually written a blog post as anonymously as I could, in that it didn't include Rob's name or my name to link me to him. And that had happened almost a year before the media got a hold of that blog post. And it was political enemies or people that were seeking to destroy Rob who then leaked that to the media and told them to investigate into his previous marriages. And so the reason that I, quote unquote, came forward was because they had my words. They had what I had written in that blog post, and they could take it and they could make it whatever they wanted to, they being the media or the powers that be. And for me, it was important to make sure that I was the voice behind what was being said. And I actually had reached out to Colby, Rob's first ex-wife, and let her know on Facebook that I had been contacted by the media and that I was planning on speaking about it in order to take ownership of my story. And she backed me 100% and said, you know, I've got your back. Let's go for it.
How long did you wrestle with the idea of coming forward and talking about this rather than saying this is something that I can't do this publicly?
It was a couple of days. Actually, probably longer than that, because Rob had let me know about a week, a little a little more than a week before reporters contacted me that they would be reaching out, that this was a possibility. And I kind of thought in the back of my mind, well, you know, I'll just let them have it. I'll tell them it's true. I was naive. I had no idea the magnitude of what it was going to be like when that story actually broke. And so when I was first contacted by reporters, it was at least 2 days of going back and forth, of talking to close friends, of conferring with Colby about what she felt we would be up against and what we'd be prepared to speak on, and realized that I had nothing to be ashamed of. I had nothing to hide, and I was, as best I could be, ready and willing to take the attacks and the questions on what I had to say, because I knew that I had truth on my side.
What were people around you, those close to you, telling you to do, or the advice that they were giving you?
To be honest, I actually really isolated myself in the midst of all of that. And one of the only people that I was conferring with was Colby, because I knew that she was going through the same thing as me. And I knew that she was going to be giving me advice that had my best interests at heart. And she was really a backbone and a helpmeet in terms of walking me through when we were both completely, you know, the media in our face, unable to leave our house, seeing our names and our faces all over television. She was right there with me, sort of figuratively holding my hand through the phone.
For you, for Dr. Ford, for Anita Hill, all three of you have said somewhat of the same thing, that this was unexpected. You didn't plan on doing this. This was not anything you had wanted to do or asked to do, but ultimately did come forward. Can you help us understand how you go through that process? Because I can completely understand why you would not want to come forward and deal with a barrage of publicity and attack and intensity and the microscope into your life. So how do you decide to do that?
This is probably the part of watching Dr. Ford's narrative unfold that has been so hard for me, because I do understand where she's coming from, and I do understand how impactful this is on her life, but also how necessary this is for her healing, that the desire to heal and to have the truth be heard and to relieve oneself of this burden is so strong that you're willing to accept the consequences. And in my case, I didn't quite grasp how big and how widespread those consequences would be. I was a little bit naive going into it, but I would do it again in a heartbeat, because the shame and the guilt and the weight that you're carrying is that people don't know. And so as soon as you've come forward and said, now I've spoken my truth, people will know. It's worth any price.
Is there any way you can describe what it feels like to be in the middle of a media storm like this?
I don't know that there is an adequate way to describe it. And I've tried in the months since to explain to people how traumatic that was. My marriage in itself was traumatic on its own. Telling that story the way that I did in my blog post was cathartic, but also traumatic on its own. And now here is this third, exponentially stronger trauma of this magnoscope or magnifying glass, as you said, being put onto my life and onto my words and onto, you know, he said, she said, what's true and what's not. And I still sometimes have some PTSD-like symptoms when I'm worried that my name might come up in a story. And I think that's part of why I've connected so much to what's happening to Dr. Ford, is because I'm reliving it through what people are doing and saying about her. I'm reliving it watching the political pundits just make, in my opinion, really dehumanizing and insensitive comments, as though she is some sort of political tool and not a human being who has been traumatized and who is upending her entire life in order to come forward and tell the truth. And it just reminds me so much of how disconnected and dehumanized I felt during that media cycle.
How did you, it's now been about 7 months, how are you doing and how are you able to feel like you're getting yourself back?
The first couple of months were a low point. I think both the aftermath of having been in the middle of the media storm, but then also just recognizing who your friends are. I lost some people in the midst of all of it, and some other people revealed their true colors, and I started to see a bigger picture of how, you know, this web in D.C. plays out. And so those first couple of months were really low and really isolating. I had also just recently relocated to New York, and so I was building, you know, my new support group and my new network up here, and so it was even more isolating in that way. And it wasn't probably until about a month or two ago that I took a deep breath and said, you know, now it's time to get my life back. Now it's time for me to move forward past this. This is no longer going to be the defining moment in my life. I'm going to continue to move forward from here.
When you hear people saying that Dr. Ford's story is politically motivated, what's your reaction to that?
I have a very strong visceral disgust to that because it is taking a person with a real and valid trauma and turning them into a tool. It is showing the lack of concern and lack of compassion that some of these people have for a person who has lived through something traumatic. And in my opinion, it's really, I guess, immature, self-important to assume that there is a person who has so little going on in their life and in their own personal narrative that they are going to take the time to tear down someone else in this way because they're not realizing how much is on the line for her. And when they talked about me as a political tool, as though I was coming forward because I had something against my husband or something against Donald Trump or something against the administration, is just so disgusting. It's really, you know, get out of your DC bubble. Look at the bigger picture. Do you really think that there are people who are dedicating their lives and taking that much time to tear down something like that? It's political theater, and it's disgusting to me.
I know that you said you have reached out to Dr. Ford. Are people reaching out to you?
No one, in terms of somebody who's been in a similar situation in the spotlight, no one ever reached out to me. And I actually just had a conversation with a very good friend a couple of weeks ago, and he was shocked how few people reached out to me. And I think that just goes to show you how disconnected and dehumanizing it is when you're thrust in the media like that. People almost think you're not real. And the only thing I can equate it to is perhaps being like a celebrity, right? That the public somehow feels like they own you and know you, but at the same time, you're still very disconnected. And so I had no lawyers, no PR people, no people who had been in similar positions, very few public personalities, and I was sort of left on my own.
And now, do you still feel like you're on your own?
I'm rebuilding. I'm rebuilding with a different, I guess, outlook and a different mindset. And so I think in some ways, yes, I'm on my own, but I've been able to find the people who are going to be able to support me as I move forward. And for me, I think that's why it was so important for me to reach out to Dr. Ford, because I don't know what her personal situation is and what her support circle was like and how personally she had prepared to come forward with this moment. I did not have any foreknowledge to be able to prepare and come forward in that moment, but I think that she did, and I wanted to make sure that she knew that I got it. I had been there. I was not just some external person commenting on her life and her motives. I remembered what it felt like to be isolated in my home, to be unable to open my email, to be terrified to turn on the news. I know what that felt like.
There's been a great deal of focus right now on Dr. Ford testifying publicly. What do you think she should do? And if you were faced with a similar situation and going in front of a Senate committee, what would impact the way you made that decision?
I think the decision is sort of made for you in terms of feeling compelled to tell the truth. And at this point, now that her name is out, now that her story is out, now that the ball is rolling, as it were, I feel like it's almost a compulsion. She has to go and tell the truth. That's me projecting myself onto her. I don't know that that's exactly how she's feeling, but it would feel as though the narrative was unfinished if I didn't continue to speak out and can carry it through to the end. And the way I think, from what I've read, that she and her attorney are handling it, I think are exactly right. It's to make sure that she's as prepared and supported as possible. I was a child when Anita Hill was in a similar position, and I remember, even though it's vague and I didn't personalize it the way that I am now, I remember how the committee was treating her, and I remember the way that it was spoken about in the media, and it was a similar sort of dehumanizing thing, as if she was being used as a tool and was on trial for coming forward and doing exactly what those confirmation hearings are for, which is to determine character and to determine eligibility. And so I know that what Dr. Ford is doing is coming forward, doing the right thing to make sure that in appointing someone to the highest court in the land, all pieces are considered and that you're confirming someone based on the full picture.
So Jenny, for women who are listening now, who maybe have gone through something similar, are wondering what they should do, could you give some advice?
Tell the truth. Speak. For me, it started in speaking with the FBI. It continued when I wrote a post and shared it somewhat anonymously on the internet. And as soon as I did that and started to feel the strength and the support, I was willing to speak. And for the healing process, for the ability to let go of that shame and that hurt, I think speaking it and putting a name to it and releasing it from within yourself is the quickest and fastest way to healing. I was at an event recently where a gentleman was talking about coming out of trauma from his own life, and he said he was worried that people would hurt him for speaking out or kill him or even shame him. He put shame at the top of the hierarchy of what would happen if he spoke out. And I want to tell people, I want to tell anyone in a situation of abuse or trauma where they're worried about the power or the influence of the person that you're about to speak out about, it's the shame that's controlling you, not that person. And the shame dissolves with speaking.
Jenny Willoughby, thank you so much for coming and sharing your story with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Jenny Willoughby is a writer and public speaker. She was married to White House Staff Secretary Rob Porter and wrote about the abuse he perpetrated against her in the viral blog post, Why I Stayed, published in April of last year. You can hear more of Jenny's story on the WNYC Studios podcast, United States of Anxiety. Their new season, out now, is about gender and power. Victims of sexual assault put a lot on the line when they come out with their stories of abuse. And you've been sharing your stories. For many, silence feels like the only way.
I never came forward because you can't undo what's been done. And the price of going forward was too high. And I'm in Eugene, Oregon.
This is Allison from San Diego. And no, I've not been brave enough to share my own story publicly. The thought of exposing myself in that way and to have to relive the events, that's been really stressing me out these past few days as I watch what's happening to Dr. Ford.
For some victims, there's a fear that they won't be believed.
This is Jennifer calling from Buffalo, New York. I was assaulted by a family member. My mother knew, but I never told anyone else in the family because I knew they wouldn't believe me.
And then there's the fear of being smeared or silenced.
This is Leslie from Omaha. I and several other people I know have spoken out about certain men in our local convention scene for assault, rape, but they're charming sociopaths. The response is always, well, he hasn't assaulted me, and they get away with it.
And finally, for many, there's a catharsis that comes with speaking and owning the truth.
I was raped when I was 18, and It took me several years of hearing the different experiences of others to realize that, yes, I was raped.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
It's Amy Walter here with you on The Takeaway. Back in 1991, when Anita Hill came forward with allegations of sexual harassment by then-Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas, many senators were quick to dismiss her claims. Thomas was ultimately confirmed with 52 votes, 11 from Democrats. Among them was Democratic Senator Dennis DeConcini, the only Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee to vote for Thomas. DeConcini opened his questioning to Anita Hill by expressing his sympathy for her and what she was going through.
I just remember as a young boy my mother telling me about sexual harassment and her job and losing her job. She was 22 years old. So I grew up with that in my mind, and she mentioned it several times as I grew in age. Had dinner with her night before last, and she got choked up just telling me again about it. 60 years later.
But he said he was frustrated by the process. Before the allegations surfaced, Thomas was well on his way to being confirmed and had already been cleared by the Judiciary Committee. Then, an FBI interview with Anita Hill got leaked to the press and set up a firestorm of controversy. The hearings were reopened. To DeConcini, the process was unfair to Judge Thomas.
I can't believe that this process is taking place to a United States appellate court judge who's been confirmed three times by this body, a life appointment, and you're even here, and I'm even here. I'm ashamed to be part of this process.
DeConcini ultimately voted to confirm. Nearly 30 years later, as Brett Kavanaugh faces allegations of sexual assault, I called up former Senator Dennis DeConcini to ask him if he's seeing echoes today of 1991.
Well, there are lots of similarities. One is at kind of the last minute, because we were pretty much through the hearings, and then this was leaked out by a Democratic senator who will not name his name because he's an old-time friend of mine, and it was anonymous, and Joe Biden had taken it up with the committee, and to Joe Biden's credit, he said, no, we're not going to do anything anonymous if she won't come forward. And at that time, we were told that she would not come forward. And then it was leaked out, and of course it was a bombshell. There was some hostility to Thomas, as there was to Kavanaugh from the Democrats on different issues. But you know, he seemed to weather that. I think he would have been confirmed as he was, but I think the votes were there.
As you watched the way in which Senator Feinstein handled what was also an anonymous allegation, what are your thoughts there?
Well, I know Senator Feinstein. I served with her, and I have the greatest respect for her. And though I can't vote in California, I would if I could. And I hope she doesn't take this as personal criticism. From what I've read, and I've not talked to her or the staff, she had this information back in July. It's unfortunate that she didn't present it then. Now, maybe she did. I'm not certain. You know, when you get anonymous tips, it's a dilemma what to do, because you're sworn to the person that gives you it that you will not disclose it. So you can't go against that. And on the other hand, when it's such an important nature as this, to me, the answer, and should have been in Thomas's hearing as well as this, is you put it off and you see whether or not there is any other evidence or complaints that might come forward.
Do you think that the Thomas hearings should have been postponed and more effort put into not just looking at Anita Hill's charges, but the potential that there's other stuff out there that wasn't uncovered?
Yes, I think they should have.
And what about with Kavanaugh?
Yes, I think they should.
And yet, in both 1991 and now, the focus is on keeping the nomination and the vote on track. Do you see a risk in Democrats making the argument for more time and giving Republicans an opportunity to cast Democrats as trying to be disruptive and not allowing a vote?
Well, what I see, Amy, is that the Democrats could somewhat blunt that by saying, we believe that there should be this review, more interviews, background information, and the vote should be put off until the month of November or the first part of December in ample time, that there could still be a vote with the Senate majority in the Republicans' strength. That's what I think would be the solution, the best fair solution, both to Kavanaugh and to Dr. Bisley.
There was actually a good deal of bipartisan support for Clarence Thomas. You supported him ultimately. Looking back now, are you still okay with that vote?
Yes, I am. There was a lot of other information. And I think her credibility to me and some others really took a hit, because after the incident supposedly happened, she went on, and he went on, became an appellate court judge, and she became a professor in, I can't remember, Oklahoma University, some university there, in the law school. And she calls him and asks him if he will come and lecture the law class. He says yes. So then she makes arrangements, and she picks him up at the airport, takes him to his hotel, picks him up the next morning, takes him to the class, takes him back to the airport. So, you know, to me, that brought some discredit to Miss Hill, because here she was, you know, having this happen to her. Now all of a sudden, oh, I can use him. Well, it's different, certainly, than any sexual implications. But to me, it had some bearing.
So we hear this line of thinking a lot about women who claim they've been harassed or assaulted. Why would you ever willingly interact with someone who did this to you? Why on earth didn't you cut off all contact with them? Women get put in this situation all the time, especially with men who are in positions of power. There's nothing unusual about this at all. But a woman who can best explain this experience is a woman who experienced it. Here's Anita Hill in her 1991 testimony when pressed on this question by Senator Alan Simpson.
If what you say this man said to you occurred, why in God's name, when he left his position of power or status or authority over you, and you left it in 1983, why in God's name would you ever speak to a man like that the rest of your life?
That's a very good question. And I'm sure that I can't not answer that to your satisfaction. That is one of the things that I have tried to do today. I have suggested that I was afraid of retaliation, I was afraid of damage to my professional life, and I believe that you have to understand that this response, and that's one of the things that I have come to understand about harassment, that this response, this kind of response, is not atypical. And I can't explain. It takes an expert in psychology to explain how that can happen. But it can happen, because it happened to me.
All this hour, we've been talking about the sexual assault allegations made against Brett Kavanaugh by Christine Blasey Ford. We heard from Jenny Willoughby, a domestic abuse survivor, about her experience going public with such a personal and traumatic story. Former United States Senator Dennis DeConcini reflected on the Anita Hill hearings 27 years ago and how the Judiciary Committee dealt with her allegations against Clarence Thomas. We also heard from many of you who were brave enough to call in and share your own stories. Thank you. The question now is, where does this all go from here? And for that, I turn to my guest, Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, and Alana Shore, Congressional Reporter for Politico. Susan, Alana, thanks for joining us. Alana, I want to start with you. What are the expectations right now that we are going to have a public hearing next week that will feature Dr. Blasey Ford testifying?
Well, that honestly depends a lot on Republicans and how strong their stomach continues to be for what has been an absolutely frenetic and chaotic week of PR for them. Certainly, they want Judge Kavanaugh to have a chance to tell his story. But with Ford's camp talking about a hearing as late as Thursday, that would mean, you know, just about 2 weeks of letting this dangle out in the public eye. And it's time that Republicans aren't spent, frankly, making their case to voters ahead of the midterms. So what I'm looking for and I'm watching is, when do they start nudging the White House to say, look, you had other nominees on this shortlist. Is it time to pull the plug? I can say I don't think that's happened yet, but we feel on the edge of that.
Susan Page, do you agree that we could actually be looking at a point, not just where we have a testimony, but that the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh actually is pulled and we start the process all over again?
You know, I think it is possible. I know that the White House and Senate Republicans don't want to go that route. There is every possibility that if his nomination is withdrawn, they'll have a lot of trouble getting a new nominee through, especially before the new Congress and the new Senate takes office in January. Who knows what's going to happen? We don't know whether there's going to be hearings next week. We don't know whether Judge Kavanaugh will stick. Although he says he will. He says he wants to defend himself. He denies categorically the allegations that are made against him. So I think this is a situation where it is really impossible to make an informed prediction on what's going to happen next. This next week is going to be really critical.
Alana, what are the issues right now determining whether or not we see the testimony? I know that both sides, Blasey Ford, her attorneys, and Chuck Grassley and his staff are going over the sort of conditions for testimony. Where are the sticking points right now?
Well, that call happened yesterday evening, and we talked to two sources who were involved in it, and there are quite a few sticking points. However, all sides described it as positive. The biggest sticking points are probably these. Ford's camp wants Kavanaugh to testify first, which Republicans see as a non-starter because effectively that robs him of his chance to respond to his accuser's allegations if he does go first. Secondarily, they don't like the idea of Ford's camp saying no outside counsel. Republicans have been looking at a female outside counsel potentially coming in and asking questions because they are, of course, deeply aware of the bad political optics of 11 men on their side of the aisle questioning Ford. Well, Ford's lawyers aren't interested in that, and that might be a non-starter. The date is somewhat more flexible. You know, Chairman Grassley had been pretty adamant about Monday, but we saw that sort of fall away yesterday as Ford's camp said, hey, look, we're willing to do next week, but just not Monday. So we really are on tenterhooks now about timing. Another thing that's important to notice is Ford's camp says, we don't really want this situation where 1,000 cameras are popping their flashbulbs in her face. She's a private person. They requested just one, you know, pool-style camera, which is the media term, right, for one photographer who sends pics to others. But that could end up being an issue.
How likely is it, Alana, that a vote actually occurs without this testimony happening, that the Republicans on the Senate committee say, we've given you these options, and we're not going to compromise anymore, we've laid this down, and we're just going to take a vote?
So much of that honestly depends on Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's communications with his few undecided votes. I think right now, red state Democratic votes were once seen as really in play for this nominee, and now not so much. So McConnell is effectively taking the temperature constantly of Jeff Flake, of Susan Collins, of Lisa Murkowski, to make sure they're all right with potentially pulling the plug on these talks and just having a vote. Of course, we're not there yet.
Susan Page, we know there are also a number of Senate red state Democrats who are up this year. There were pressure on them to support the Kavanaugh nomination. What do we know about them and what these new allegations have meant for their decision whether to support him or not?
Well, Senator McCaskill from Missouri has announced she'll vote against his nomination, although she cited his stance on campaign finance reform, not these latest allegations. But from the trio that we thought might well vote for him, who voted for Justice Gorsuch, for instance, I think that's going to be, those are going to be very tough votes for Republicans to get now, because there is now an increased imperative among Democrats that this is a serious allegation. It's on top of other concerns that they had about Judge Kavanaugh. And I think that's why Republicans are now thinking they really need to hold every Republican vote. And that means that they cannot give the appearance of not listening to the allegations. I think that makes it very hard for Senator Grassley to not have a hearing if Dr. Ford is not setting unreasonable conditions. You know, the condition that she goes second, I think that might be seen as unreasonable. The condition that she wants to limit the number of cameras in the room, that seems that could seem very reasonable and something on which the committee would be forced to compromise. The question on who does the questioning, maybe it should have occurred to Republicans that they might want to have put a woman senator on the Judiciary Committee with the benefit of this hindsight.
And what do we know just about the political repercussions for how this all plays out? What do we think about ultimately where this goes?
I think the repercussions could be considerable. And it depends in part on what happens. If she doesn't seem to be given her say, if they kind of rush this through, they confirm a justice who's going to be a critical swing vote on the court, I think that could further energize women voters who we've seen remarkable activism from since that women's march the day after the inauguration of President Trump. If he doesn't make it through, and that seems unfair, maybe that energizes Republican voters.
Susan Page, USA Today had a poll out, the public's view of Brett Kavanaugh. What did you all find?
This was, I thought, very interesting. This poll was taken with Ipsos on Wednesday and Thursday, so it could not be more current. It's in the wake of these allegations getting some currency. And what we found was unprecedented. We found a plurality of Americans opposed the confirmation of Judge Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. And not since we began to poll on Supreme Court nominations have we had a situation where a plurality opposed. Now, sometimes the support hasn't been that fervent. Harriet Myers, for instance, she never got that much support before her nomination was withdrawn. But this is a new situation. And the other thing we found a big partisan divide. You'd expect that. Another thing we found was a big divide on gender. Women oppose the nomination by double digits. Men support the nomination by single digits. And it goes to who do you believe with these sexual allegations. Women by double digits say, I believe the accuser. Men by single digits say, I believe his denials.
The other thing that I noticed in that poll that was quite remarkable was voters believed that ultimately Brett Kavanaugh would be confirmed, that this would hurt Republicans politically, and it would hurt the Me Too movement. How do we make sense of all of those disparate views in one place?
So 40% say I oppose his nomination, but only 11% say he won't be confirmed. So there is an expectation that he is likely to be confirmed. And that carries some big risks, it seems to me, for Republicans if they win confirmation. Of course, they want to win confirmation. This is an important vote for the White House and for Senate Republicans. But you'll have a lot of people who thought something happened that they didn't think ought to happen. We ask, who is it going to hurt? If the nomination gets pushed through by Republicans, despite these allegations, who will that hurt? Americans thought it would hurt Senate Republicans' chances of holding the Senate in the midterm elections. They thought it would hurt President Trump, and they also thought it would hurt the Me Too movement.
Alana, I want to move to Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's been in the center of this controversy. Of course, she is the person who had hold of that anonymous letter. There's a tremendous amount of criticism about her decision to not make this letter public. Can you talk to us a little bit about what she is doing right now and the feelings about her and the expectations for her as we go forward in this process?
Yeah, the coverage of this honestly has been very confusing because it's a confusing issue. Essentially, Senator Feinstein is saying, I hung onto this letter, didn't give it to the FBI until my hand was forced by a leak to the media, because how could I have done that confidentially? If the FBI starts investigating someone, it's pretty easy for the press to get a wind of what's happening. So she essentially waited to act until this leak forced her hand. And of course, we don't know who first leaked Ford's letter. That's still a mystery. Now, Republicans say, that's just not true. You should have referred this to the FBI earlier in such a way as to protect her confidentiality. So that's really the crux of the Feinstein argument. And when we talk about Feinstein being under fire, it's under fire from Republicans inside the Beltway. Her own liberal challenger out in California for re-election, Kevin De Leon, has his own sexual misconduct issues in the state legislature out there that have kind of backfired on him as he's tried to criticize her. So yeah, she's taking heat, but it's not really imperiling her political future, and none of her fellow Democratic senators have criticized her on the record at all. So the Feinstein story is pretty murky.
The other group of folks were paying close attention to, Susan, are the evangelical community, specifically the leadership of the evangelical community, which continues to support Brett Kavanaugh, wants to see this nomination get through. The concern they have is that many of their voters supported Donald Trump with the belief that he was going to be appointing Supreme Court justices. This could derail that. Can you talk to us a little bit about what this means at this moment for the evangelical community and what they are saying about these charges against Brett Kavanaugh?
You know, this has been one of the interesting things politically with President Trump, because he had the support of the evangelical community despite credible accusations of sexual misconduct by himself. And the evangelical leadership stuck with him, and so did a lot of evangelical voters, despite questions about his own character. And that was very transactional on their part, because President Trump promised to deliver on issues, including first and foremost, the appointment of a Supreme Court justice who would move toward overturning Roe v. Wade. That is a fundamental animating issue for a lot of evangelical voters to further restrict abortion rights. And so President Trump has delivered on what he promised evangelical voters, and they've stuck with him even in the face of controversy. And we see the same dynamic happening here with Judge Kavanaugh. One question I have that I don't think we can answer at this point is, do evangelical voters agree with their leaders that questions of personal character are irrelevant when you have the opportunity to score a political victory? And that's something I think we don't know yet. One concern might be for Republicans, not that evangelical voters would then vote Democratic if they found that unacceptable, but they might just not vote at all.
I want to get you both to weigh in, too, on the White House reaction and what they're doing about this. President Trump, who is in Las Vegas up early, tweeted this out. I've no doubt if the attack on Dr. Ford was as bad as she said, charges would have been immediately filed with local law enforcement. I asked that she bring those filings forward. We can learn the date, time, and place. At another point, he said that this was about Democrats obstructing. This was a political process. Alana, it seemed for a moment, at least, or a couple of days, that the president was kind of taking a hands-off approach here, saying we want to hear from Dr. Blasey Ford, trying to stay out of the middle of this, and now has jumped right on in.
Yeah, this is looking like it could be Republicans' worst nightmare soon, because that relative reticence from the president had given Republicans a little room to maneuver without feeling like Trump was getting out there and blasting Ford's credibility. So it let Republicans look a little fair on this point. But it's important to state with regards to this tweet that the majority of victims of sexual assault of this nature do not come forward. And so this expectation that why didn't she say something just isn't really borne out by the actual facts with regard to these episodes. But politically speaking, this is just not good for Republicans. This comes after a close ally of the judge laid out a fairly tortured and potentially defamatory mistaken identity theory on Twitter after hyping it for days. So Republicans are really lurching right now when it comes to defending this nominee.
Susan?
And I agree with that, but I would also say that President Trump has made it clear he will pull this nomination if it is politically necessary for him. He's not invested personally in Judge Kavanaugh the way, for instance, President George H.W. Bush was in Clarence Thomas.
All right. Thanks to you both, Susan Page from USA Today, Alana Shore from Politico. That's all for us today. Remember, You can always find us on Facebook, leave a comment there, or tweet us at The Takeaway, or you can send one to me at Amy E. Walter. Thanks so much for being with us this week. I'm Amy Walter. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a European-made language learning program. Babbel teaches practical conversation in Italian, Russian, Swedish, and other languages. Available in the App Store or online at babbel.com.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.